Okay, just to let you know where we're heading, we're going to go approximately 45 more minutes at the panel, and then at about 10:15, we'll open up the floor to questions, for just to let you know. And, of course, I want to urge and welcome everybody back. We start bright and early, 9 o'clock tomorrow morning, all day till 5 o'clock. You can come for part all, tell your friends, etc., the schedule you have. Remember, I will remind you again on the free MP3s. If you're interested, text support at torremotion.org. And time for the second half.
You know, Dr. Finkelman alluded to the fact that there have been previous disputes in Jewish history. Anybody who is a student of Jewish history understands that the Jews have always argued vociferously with one another, whether it's Pharisees and Sadducees or Hellenists and traditionalists or Karaites versus the rabbinic establishment or Hasidim and Mitnagdim. Jews have argued. Jews have called each other names. They've branded each other as heretics. They've, even when they had power, yes, they've killed one another. Even in our time, obviously, the post-Enlightenment era creates a new sensibility where you have not just traditionalists arguing with other traditionalists, but you have interdenominational squabbling. There's a very interesting comment that Rav Shimshon Raphael Hirsch makes when he says that God has not promised the covenant of his rule to those who proclaim peace, peace at any price. He has promised it to the zeal of Pinchas, to him in whom the name of God opposes every mocking departure from the law of God, the only power before which everyone has to bow. So that is not a compromise kind of statement. And it's a strikingly parallel position was actually taken by one of the leading figures of Reform Judaism, Eugene Borowitz, who wrote the following in 1984. He said, had Klal Yisrael been our, meaning the Reform movement's, most significant concern, we never would have brought liberal Judaism into being because its creation seriously divided the Jewish community by defying the accepted community leadership and the established traditions of our people. So philosophically, it seems everybody on all sides understands that there's unity, and then there's other things. There's positions where people stand on principle and feel like my principles are more important than unity, and we all know that harmony between people is desirable, but maybe there are things that are more important than harmony. In other words, what does each of us find non-negotiable? I think that's one of the key questions that really emerges here, and I wanted to start by asking Rav Lau a question because he raised the specter of Rav Kook, who's a very interesting figure, really, in all of this. Rav Kook had a very complex understanding of polar opposites, even the challenge of atheism, as somehow pointing that you could have all of this argument, all of this opposition, and somehow it could lead to a larger unity. And Rav Kook writes, in each faction and each movement, there are certainly things with which I cannot agree, but this cannot cause my love, full of that flame which burns within me, for our people and all its individuals to be diminished even by a hair's breadth. It is sustained within me in equal measure to those who respect me and those who despise me. I love all of them without limits. Now, my question to you is whether the facts on the ground are not a little more complicated, right? In certain respects, and this is what I was talking about before, you know, we talk about Ahavat Yisrael, which is a wonderful notion, but there seem to be certain decisions that are mutually exclusive, right? Either someone born of a Jewish father and a non-Jewish mother is a Jew or isn't a Jew, at least according to one faction of the community. Either driving on Shabbat is prohibited or it's permitted. Either Kashrut is an archaic ritual destined to block Jews from contact with other people, or it's a prescription for remaining sanctified and dealing with the Ratzon Hashem. So I guess what I'm asking is, on some level, don't you have to choose? And having certain principles means that somebody is going to be left on the outside of your choices. So how does that reconcile with what we call Ahavat Yisrael.
I will start by saying that we are speaking tonight just about inside the family, mean about Ahavat Yisrael, because we need to speak a lot about Ahavat Adam, about human being, about humanism. This is a big issue, and I must tell you, I don't know anything about what's happened in North America, but in the religious Zionist in Israel, this is the issue that we should look carefully about the local patriotism inside the Jewish family and the inside needs, and about humanism. This is I put outside the discussion, but it's very important to remember that it's a subject. Now about Ahavat Israel, it's a real question. I feel that everyone, each one, that have any connection to Am Israel, he is part of my family. Truly. Rav Uziel, late Rav Uziel, was the first chief rabbi Sfaradi in Eretz Israel, in Medinat Israel. He wrote many times about Zera Israel. He didn't mean to say that everyone is a Jew, but many times he used the idea that if someone came, enough, I will not return back to the conversion business, but when he spoke about Am Israel, he said part of that is people who came from Zera Israel, mean the father, the grandfather, they came from Am Israel, and maybe they married out, maybe the third generation already out, but they are part of Am Israel. And by thinking with his eyes, I really believe that if we try talking about family, talking about brothers and sisters, not about neighbors, but about inside the home, we will change the language. I will use the phrase from Parashat Shavua, when Abraham said to Lot, "Hipared na me'alai," right? Separate from me. If you will go to the left, I to the right, left. And the pashut, the simple explanation Rashi gave in this pasuk is that we need to find space, each one his own space. You are big enough and rich enough to have your own place. So we parted, separate. But don't think that this separation will be that you are in one side of the world and I'm in the other side. Hipared na me'alai, said Rashi, I will be close to you. Bechol makom shetelech, wherever you will go, ani ehye letzidcha, I will be next and nearby you. If you will go to the left, I will be near you in the right. And if you will go to the right, I will be nearby you in the left. Kol makom shetelech, we are family. And I think that the most important message from this Rashi and from Avraham Avinu act is that we should not protect like a patron everyone. We need to give a space, as we said in the Tfilah, notnim reshut ze laze leakdish li yotzram benachat ruach. Each one have his own shita, own ashkafa, and he need his place. But without walls, without separation, that kehilot, like in Germany, in Rav Shimshon Nefael Hirsch, a decision, that the kehilot is separated completely. This is something that we cannot accept, because we are family. Neighbors, sometimes, if they want to have quiet and nice neighborship, they will build their walls, a fence. Okay. If we remember the poem of Fast, he said that we remember just this line. But he said that in the end it will build not just a wall, but a war between the neighbors. This is our other subject. But if we are not neighbors, if we are brothers and sisters, how can we live with walls? I will give you a small example, because I have no relationship in Jerusalem, not a close relationship, and even not a conflict with Reform and Conservative. I meet them. How many we have in Jerusalem or in Eretz Israel? Not so many. We have a strong secular parties and neighbors and maybe organizations around us. And we need to learn how to deal with them, not secular, that mean you are a Jew that not Shomer Shabbat. But you have your own shita. You have your own hashkafa. You are a positive chiloni. Not just lo shomer. It's not a negative thing. It's in a positive way. I have neighbors nearby my shul. It's the Kohen Gadol of the secular in Israel. Professor Yaakov Malchin is a very famous chiloni lemehadrin. And I want to tell you that in the last Yom Kippur, he stood on the podium in Bet Knesset Ramban, Erev Yom Kippur, after Tfilat Arvit, and we did what we called Cheshbon Nefesh Israeli. He stood and spoke about the Israeli society. He's a really a philosopher with Hashkafa, and he stood Yom Kippur in my shul. And I'm very proud with that. Year before, I invited a professor, Yaron Ezrahi, another Kohen from the secular, from Hebrew U. I think that Professor Tamaros knows them quite well. Year before, I invited Professor Ruth Gabizon. All of them secular, proud to be secular, but they are my brother and sister. And they will be invited always to my shul, on the podium, on the holidays, to speak and to share with us Hashkafa. I feel strong enough with my Orthodox way to invite everyone, include the Haredim, if they will come. I'm not sure that they heard about this event.
Oh, they heard.
Okay. But to say that I bring this machloket from Eretz Israel to Chutz Laaretz, really, it's not serious. I think that you have the problem in North America that without any kavod to the hashkafa, that it's not the ultra-Orthodox hashkafa, you have it here, we don't bring it from Eretz Israel, and we need to face it. And if we have Ashkafa, if we believe that we are living with Shlichut, so stand and do your Shlichut.
I want to continue the pessimistic direction from before after Rav Benny's optimistic turn, and then I'll go back to something a little more optimistic. The halftime that we just had symbolized for me something a little bit interesting, that the first half of the conversation was about potential splits within Orthodoxy, and the second half of the conversation, the shorter half of the conversation, is about splits between Orthodoxy and other movements. I think as early as just a few years ago, that split would have been unthinkable. The primary question about Jewish unity and about pluralism and about tolerance within the Orthodox community was about Orthodox relationships to non-Orthodox movements as individuals, as movements, etc. And now that's already the old conversation. The new conversation is about the brand new splits that we've developed that threaten to tear us apart. I think that's sad. The more optimistic thing I want to say has to do with the very fact of denominationalism and factionalism within Judaism, and think about the possibilities that the historical conditions that have been thrust on us create. And I'm going to say this a little more sharply than I believe it for the sake of the conversation. The consensus among historians is that Orthodoxy is not the Judaism of the Middle Ages today. Orthodoxy is a response to modernity. Orthodoxy is that branch of Judaism that maintains halachic practice in the face of of compelling alternatives and tempting alternatives, and that the fact of those tempting alternatives really affects the entire fabric of Orthodox life. The democratization of education, women's education, you know, the creation of summer camp, all kinds of things, the ways in which the attempt to create an Orthodox identity in the face of serious alternatives, attractive alternatives, really affects the entire fabric of how Orthodoxy works. And that is because we live, as I mentioned in passing before, in a pluralistic age, in an age of freedom, in which more or less religious identity is voluntary, and anybody who wants to can decide what to be Jewish or not be Jewish, or to be Jewish as they see fit. And from an Orthodox perspective, this is to a certain degree a tragedy, because all of a sudden you have these movements, Reform, Conservative, Reconstructionist, this various kinds of movements, at least in North America, these are the primary denominations, secular Zionism, Yiddishism, all these kinds of alternatives that pop up that are not dedicated to Shmirat HaMitzvot in the way that Orthodoxy imagines it. And that is, at one level, a tragedy. But it also, it seems to me, opens up some very intriguing possibilities. Rabbeinu mentioned before the requirement of rabbis to see their constituency as all of Am Yisrael. And it's very difficult to disagree with that, but I'm going to do so anyway. And suggest the possibility that what this modern, voluntary, pluralistic condition allows is for Orthodoxy to say, with a great, and for any other group to say, with a great deal of self-confidence, listen, this is who I am, take it or leave it. And if you don't like it, you're welcome to do something else, not because I think that it's a good idea for you to do something else, but because you don't have to ask my opinion. And that creates a possibility for Orthodoxy to do its thing, to define its constituency with a certain kind of narrowness, and to say, I understand that under the conditions that modernity has thrust on us, I have no option but to be, to a certain degree, self-contained, and to state my position, and if you want to come along, you're welcome to come along, and if you don't want to come along, I'm sorry to hear that, but there's not a lot I can do about it. And I think that attitude, I can't quite translate it into ideology, but as a sensibility or as an attitude, I think it creates a possibility for Orthodoxy really to come out unabashedly with what it stands for and what it believes in, and not to get mired in interdenominational politics and infighting and polemics and kvetching. Not because I agree with this or that movement, but because I'm simply aware of the fact that they don't need my haskama to do what they want to do. And I think that that's a possible way of Orthodoxy to think about this historical condition has created this possibility for us to state our opinion unabashedly and still avoid some of the politics and the polemics, with the caveat that when we deal with things like who Jews are going to marry several generations from now, that perhaps that luxury doesn't apply.
So which principles are non-negotiable in any attempt to bridge the distance between different groups? To me, it's a no-brainer. All principles are non-negotiable. If they are truly principles, you don't negotiate. nor should you have to. I think part of the problem that we face, I think Rabbi Lau was correct, that the friction between communities is not something that has to be imported from Israel. It's already here. What is not here is a sense that there is an irrevocable distancing that we're on the verge of making. But there is too much of a sense that if this is my principle, I can't talk to others, that if I do talk to them, if there's a conversation, either personally or in the press, it means I am taking responsibility for the other. I think that is the crucial question, the crucial point. Not everything that others whom you speak with say is your problem or are you taking responsibility for. We learn that in marriage. Not everything that our spouse says and does should become a reflection upon ourselves. When we don't learn that, our marriages fall apart. The same is true of the community. We can find ways of talking to each other without taking responsibility. When we get to a point that talking does take responsibility for the other, and here I believe that in some kinds of interdenominational conversation, our very sitting together at times does lend a credence to other groups that they are desperately looking for, then reasonable people can disagree. I believe we have to draw back. That does not apply within our own community. It sometimes applies to people outside of the community. That does not mean that I can't do the same thing as Rabbi Lau. I'm not sure that I would invite a secular professor to speak in my shul on Yom Kippur, only because it's a short day, and I think that there are other things about personal tshuva that may take priority. But I can tell you that I've had the same experience. I recall standing at the Israeli consulate a few years ago, getting introduced to a deputy consul, who was told about my job at the Wiesenthal Center, but nonetheless, his first words to me, looked up from his desk, looked at me, did not introduce himself, and said, "Ani lo dati, ani chiloni." From there, fast forward a couple of years, after numerous Shabbatot at my house and Yamim Tovim, he left Los Angeles with fastest friends. My kids visit him when they're learning in Israel. And he said, "You know, I think I should send my kids, not to a Haredi school, but I think they should have a Torah education that I did not have." So there are so many of these opportunities in so many different walks of life. I do believe that there is another area in which we cannot, if you have any problem of figuring out what is a principle, I will try this out. Rabbi Broid will promptly pop up with all the people who disagreed with Rav Moshe's embracing of the Marshal in Bava Kamma. But there's a famous Yamshal Shlomo in Bava Kamma who says that when it comes to falsifying Torah, it is Yehareg Val Yavar, even if it costs you your life, you may not make a misstatement of what Torah is. Now, reasonable people can disagree. When my students call and ask for advice about attending a simcha, attending a bar mitzvah or a wedding outside of the Orthodox community, under many situations, I will say, I couldn't do it, you can. You're not a spokesman for the community. I don't see a problem with you going into a Reform synagogue, conservative synagogue, as long as they know, understand that you're not davening there, you're not part of it. But when the same people will ask, "Okay, I've been invited by my best friend to sign on a ketuvah. I'll be one signatory. The other signatory will be a woman Reform rabbi. Can I do that?" That, I think, is distorting Torah. That verges on a chilul Hashem, because there you're making a statement that of what halacha is or isn't, and that cannot be made. I will offer, and with this I close, I think a beautiful insight, again, of my favorite previous Torontonian, Rav Yaakov Kamenetsky Zatzal, once again, who was asked at a different Torah Masorah convention many decades ago to speak about disunity in the community. It's not a new problem. So he got up and he said, "Mistoma, the Eilam wants me to speak, doesn't want me to speak about yeshivas versus Chabad. And a lot of people said, no, speak about it. No. He ignored them. He said, Nesama the other wants me to speak about Vayu against Lakewood, which is supposed to translate broadly into modern orthodoxy against versus yeshiva orthodoxy. He told a beautiful story, which we don't have time for, but he ended with this. He said, the Rambam is a posek. And I believe, said Rav Yaakov, that there is a psak halacha of who's inside and who's outside. Even within the Jewish people, whom we are bidden and required to love, whether inside or not, there is a halachic guideline separating the insider and the outsider. And I think many people in this room, with the exception of Dr. Mark Shapiro, who is not here tonight but was here in the past, would be happy with this. He points out that before the Rambam introduces his 13 Ikarei Hadat, the 13 principles of faith, actually right after, not before, he says the halachic import of these 13 principles of faith is that those who subscribe to them, whether or not they are fully compliant with halacha, whether they act the way we want all the time, if they subscribe to these 13 principles, they must be regarded as insiders, not outsiders. And we should deal with them with the full complement of acceptance and Ahavat Yisrael. I believe that with all the differences that we're discussing here, every part of the Orthodox community that we're talking about falls under that umbrella. And that's a powerful suggestion for how we bend our minds in looking at other people in the community.
I just rudely asked to interrupt, but I want to disagree with that reading of the Rambam on two counts. One is that the Rambam doesn't say insider and outsider. He says Jew and non-Jew. And as far as I can tell, nobody has ever poskened a person out of the Jewish people theologically in practice, with the exception of that passage. I don't want to say nobody with the exception. I don't think in practice the Jewish community has ever done that. And secondly, Mark Shapiro may not be here, but his book speaks for itself, and it is quite clear that the Jewish people and Jewish thought as a whole has never defined the 13 principles of faith, again, in practice, as the definition of who's in and out.
I think we'll have to check the passage later. In the meantime, I'll side with Rav Yaakov.
I listened to my three panelists speak, and in truth, not a word they said resonated with me. I think in reality, life is about concentric circles of closeness, and that it's not about inside and outside. It's about how close and how distant. And that I believe in Zechut HaAdam, intrinsic rights of all human beings. I also believe in a closer circle to me, which is me Yehudi, which is I have a closer connection to Jews than I do with Gentiles. I believe that there's a phrase in Halacha called Achecha B'mitzvot, which is the recognition of the fact that I have a closer affinity to Jews who observe mitzvot than I do to people who are Jewish but don't observe mitzvot. You know, my law students in law school, they complain bitterly because not only won't I sit in a chair, I pace. And my law students don't like going to class. Law students in general don't like going to class. So the law school has a service. It has a videotape camera up there, and they videotape all the classes, and you can watch class online. And my students complain that I defeat this process because I pace back and forth. So I walk in and out of the camera, and they find it very irritating, so they have to come to class. And if I were really good at what I did, that I would just sit in a chair and lecture and not pace back and forth, and that way nobody would have to come to class. They could just watch online. So I just smile when they say this. The same thing is here, because here I'm not pacing, but I'm shuffling back and forth. You'll just have to live with that difficulty. And if you're having a hard time listening to online, come to class. I think that in reality, when the Jewish community thinks about, when I think about community, I don't define people as in or out, or yes or no, but I think that in fact we define people concentrically, and that while all of us would like to imagine we have an infinite amount of care and an infinite amount of love, in fact none of us do. And that when we lay out how we share our finite resources, we can say, I believe in the rights of all humanity, but nonetheless, I don't give an enormous amount of money to save the Cambodians. Not because they shouldn't be saved, but because it's less my problem. That's not to diminish their humanness at all, but it does diminish my care for them. It's important, in my view, not to define people as in or out, but it's to recognize a very realistic posture, which is we have notions of concentric circles of care. I have family members who I care about more, frankly, than your family. Not because your family is unimportant, but because from my perspective, my family is more important. And there are things that I would give to my family, like a kidney, that I might not give to your family members, not because they're not deserving of a kidney, but because they're not necessarily deserving of my kidney. Now, I know that that sounds terribly selfish, but the honest truth is I have only two kidneys, and I can only really give away one of them, and I'm reserving them for a family member in need. And I think, by the way, halacha recognizes that that's proper and valid, and that your own family members have a greater claim on charity than, for example, strangers do. Not because your family members are less human, more human than other family members, but rather because they're yours. So I think that we should never read people out of people that we care about, except for incredibly evil, dark people. So there are some people in this world who I genuinely don't care about because they're downright evil people. They're Hitlerites. They set out to kill me. They're not deserving of any of my concern, and the world would be a better place if they just disappeared. And indeed, given the opportunity, I would help them disappear. However, most people in the world don't fit into that category. Most people in the world are simply distant from me in various degrees. So I care about Reform Jews more than I care about Cambodians, because when I define who I am, it's by the construct of being Jewish. By this definition, I care more about Achecha b'mitzvos, people who share with me not just a Jewish identity, but a commitment to observe God's law. That doesn't make them better people. It makes them instead closer kin to me. And so I think that while it's possible to construct a universe like Rav Kook did, which is that we genuinely love with infinite amounts everybody who's Jewish and ultimately everybody who's human, I think that it's very hard for almost all normal people to be manifest that philosophy. And while it can be an aspirational goal of some theological worth, it can't in fact be a proper directive to build society. If we want to have a real proper directive to build society, we build circles of care, and we manifest ourselves in various degrees around that circle of care. I see within halachic Jewry at least four circles of care. I see humanity. Jewish law recognizes the value of every single human being we are, to grab an old cliche, all God's children, all human beings are of intrinsic worth, and we ought to be manifest care in some way. We also recognize that there's a notion of caring for fellow Jews, and that we ought to be manifest our care for fellow Jews in a greater degree and a more profound sense than we manifest our care for all humanity. Not because we don't care about all humans, but because we need to be manifest our care for all Jews more than we're manifest our care for everybody. And those of us who are in the Orthodox community ought to recognize the notion of achecha b'mitzvot, that we care about people who are in the community of those who are Sabbath observant more than we care about the people who are not. Not that the people who are not people we should care for, but because these are people we should care for more. And we should be even more careful about people who are within our own family or community. And that this is a more realistic model for thinking about our relationships. So it's easy to get very abstractly philosophical and imagine a universe where zechut ha'adam, the rights of all human beings, is a central idea, and I would say it is a central idea within Judaism. But it's important when we think about Jewish unity, or unity with all human beings, that we put each in its proper context and its proper situation, and we allocate our resources realistically, reflecting the fact that if we are to succeed in being manifest care, it can't be because we manifest care about every value equally. My teacher, Rabbi Bleich, is hostile to vegetarianism. And when you he's hostile to vegetarianism, and when you ask him why, so I can tell you for myself, he looked at me and said, with a wicked smile on his face, some people, he said, he looked at me, should be vegetarians because they wouldn't be so fat. And that's not a bad thing. But most people, I took that personally, he meant it. It was words worth hearing from one's rebbeim, that one has failings of this type. But he said most people who are vegetarians do so because they manifest more care or as much care for animals as they manifest for human beings. And it's a sin, Rabbi Bleich would say, to harmonize the way we treat animals with the way we treat people. Not because animals aren't entitled to any care. I suppose there's a circle of care beyond humans called all living creatures. But an egregious sin takes place when you harmonize all your levels of care and you say to yourself, I care as much for the seal in northern Canada as I do for my own child. That's a sin. It's a misappropriation of your ethical values. You not only have to care for everything, you have to care for everything in the right amount and the right proportion. So when you think about how to be manifest these values, I think it's not enough to say, do I believe in the rights of all humanity? Check. Do I believe in the rights of all Jews? Check. Do I believe in the rights of all religious Jews? Yes. Do I believe in the rights of the seals? Check. I don't think that's the right approach. I think you have to instead share with the community not just that this is a value, but that this is a value that's a 57. And this is a value that's a 16. This is a value that's a 2. And there's nothing wrong with being manifest our parochialism, to pick a complex word, in how we share these concentric circles of value. Everybody here on this panel is my friend.
I'm going to ask a question. You know, I get the feeling that everybody liked what you just said, but I did not. And I'm going to tell
you.
And
you're not a friend.
And I'm going to tell you why.
You
lose friends quickly. Because in real life, I think that, in other words, generically, sure, there are circles. But in real life, the circles get much more complicated, don't they? As you well know, right? So I'm going to ask you two questions. Number one, do you relate more to an intelligent, articulate, moderate, passionate Christian or to somebody in the Jewish people who lives a thoroughly divorced from religion, utterly materialistic life? Do you relate more to one of your co-religionists who manifests behavior you find alienating, appalling, can't even understand what's going on, and not just a few of them, or to surrounded by secular Jews who manifest righteousness, kindness, compassion. And once we get into all of these little circles, we find that there are circles inside of circles inside of circles, and the whole thing gets quite complicated. And my question really is whether we can divvy up these things quite so easily, or whether it really doesn't come down to a much more case-by-case basis as opposed to generic circle drawing.
So I think that you've confused two terms. How I relate to people and how I care about people are very different. I relate to people who share my idiosyncrasies and my quirks because they share them. And that, of course, I relate best to my colleagues in the law school who think like me and who divvy up the bonus pool in the law school on a yearly basis. They're my friends, and I like them. Let the record reflect that fact. Having said that, how I manifest my care is an ethical construct and not a social construct. I can have people who I relate to and who are my friends on a social level who aren't necessarily within my ethical construct of care. So for many, many, many years, we had a pet cat in my house. It was a wonderful cat. It provided comfort for my children. It was really a loving, good animal. My children related to it. To a lesser extent, I related to it, although I was allergic to it terribly. But at the end of the day, it's important to keep in mind that while I had a better relationship with my cat than I have with some religious Jews, it's not a manifestation of my ethical values. It's just a reflection of my social skills or lack thereof. So the answer to your question is, and this is very important, I would be manifest.
Now, exactly who is the cat in this analogy?
Is it the
Christian? Is it the second? Who's the cat here?
The Hameven Yavin.
Well, I'm not Maven.
Then you will never be Yavin. I think that the answer is that I think that the answer is that I can get along with and relate to on a social level people who are different from my concentric circle, but I manifest my ethics of concern far more for people who are closer to me. So honestly, there are people out there who I like more than my own children. I have a child here. She's not the one I'm talking about. Let the record reflect that. If she's in the room, she's not the one that I'm talking about. And if you're the one that I'm talking about who's watching on the internet, it's not you either. But I don't think I'd give a kidney to anybody other than a close family member. Not because I don't relate to you, but because I wouldn't be manifest my circle of care that way. Even though if I had to sit and talk to somebody for 20 minutes, it might not necessarily be each and every one of my children. But that's not a manifestation of care. Who you would donate a kidney to, who you donate a pint of blood to, who you give $1,000 to, who you jump on a hand grenade for. These are ways that you manifest care and love. Who you chit-chat with over lunch, these might just be social concerns for who you relate to. And I think that halacha mandates for us concentric circles of care when it comes to crucial decisions, although it doesn't mandate this when it comes to mere social concerns.
I want to argue just with one point. First of all, I cannot bring a of course, not jokes, but also not stories. But when you mention the phrase achicha b'mitzvot, I ask myself what kind of mitzvot you are talking about. You say, immediately you said orthodox. Orthodox are religious orthodox, are achicha b'mitzvot. And I'm think about my kids in the army, about myself in the army. I find brothers and sisters in mitzvot do nothing without any connection with Shabbat and Kashrut, without nothing between Ben Adam LaMakom. But they full mitzvot of Ben Adam LaChavero, Ben Adam LeAmo, Ben Adam LeMedinato. And if you will check yourself, when you spoke about Achicha, you meant to say Ben Adam LaMakom. And it's completely wrong. Because the Gemara know to write clearly that we can see tzaddik she'oseh ra. We are now learning dafyoim in kiddushin. It's kiddushin memalef. Yesh tzaddik ra, said the Gemara. Tzaddik ra mean a person who do many mitzvot ben adam lamakom, but he is terrible by his relationship in the area, in the society life. Tzadik ra. And we have rasha tov. And when we are talking about achicha, I think that we should be very careful with that. Without all the feeling of the family feeling. But the idea of achicha. If I see Israelis, I'm talking about my small area in Israel. If I see Israeli who give his life to help his society, not just in the army, but the whole way. You know, sometimes it's with a very simple gray acts, paying tax, living a normal citizen life. And he is my neighbor. And he is very, very strong, careful with itnahagut. Ben Adam lachavero, ben Adam lemishpachto, leamo. He is my brother according to the law, according to the Jewish law. This is achicha b'mitzvot. Nachon, not with all mitzvot. I think that we should be very careful by this circle that you built. And when we are talking not about feelings, but about the others, we should check ourselves a bit more. And just to end, if we mention the Rambam, who is in and who is out, we all said in Agadah Shel Pesach about Rasha. Ma'u Omer? So we said, לפי שהוציא עצמו מן הכלל, כפר בעיקר. So if someone asks me who is in and who is out, I say, if you identify yourself out, so you are out, I will not push you out.
Rabbi Boyd is going to get the last comment. Then I'm going to take questions from the floor. So just want to explain the procedure. We're going to set up a mic right here in front. If people have a question, I'm going to ask them to line up at the mic. That'll be in a few minutes' time. If people have a question, they should prepare it now.
I think Rabbi Lau is correct. I think that the unique construct in Israel of building a Jewish society has made determining who is achecha b'mitzvot in Israel to be exceptionally difficult, because we have a community of apparently very religious people who shirk the primary responsibility in the halachic system of self-defense. And there's no getting around the fact that it will remain a blot and a stain on the face of orthodoxy that so many orthodox men exempt themselves from the fundamental sacrifice of the Jewish people in the land of Israel. And it's made determining who is achecha b'mitzvot in the land of Israel extremely difficult. And I recognize and understand that the construct of the army and self-defense has created paradigms in Israel that don't fit into the historical model of community as it was defined by the Rishonim and Achronim. And I think that observation is correct. We have in Israel many people who are clearly serving the Jewish people who are not observant of Jewish law, and many people who are observant of Jewish law who are shirking a fundamental responsibility. There's no doubt that that's correct. But I don't think that that observation fundamentally reflects the life in the diaspora, where we don't face these pressures and stresses that seem to be part and parcel of Jewish life in the state of Israel. So I think Rabbi Lau's comment is correct, but not universal, and doesn't in fact reflect Jewish life in Toronto or Atlanta or New York, even though I think it's a very astute and halachically proper observation when you think about the nature of life in the land of Israel. For those who are interested in seeing this expressed in the more yeshivish construct, it's worth looking at Rav Moshe's tshuva with regard to the falashas, where Rav Moshe says, imagine an intellectual construct, he says. Think if the Jews in Brooklyn were in danger and the falashas in Ethiopia were powerful, would they muster an army to come rescue the Jews in Brooklyn? And Rav Moshe says, since it seems clear that the answer is yes, that they would come rescue us in our time of need, we should go rescue them in their time of need, even though he's not sure that they are Jewish. I've always found Rav Moshe's observation to be an astonishingly worthwhile precedent, not for the Falashian army in Ethiopia coming to rescue the Jews in Brooklyn, although given the financial plight in New York, it might yet come to that. But it stands as an enormous precedent for the notion of the sanctity of a person, even if he just thinks he's a Jew, who's prepared to sacrifice his life for Kedushas Ha'am v'Kedushas Ha'aretz. That's not to be diminished, but it also doesn't reflect the reality of life in the diaspora.
If you have a question, please approach the mic. But prior to that, I'd like you to give all these speakers a big hand. There's a few ground rules here, just off the top, as it's late. No speeches, no statements, just questions, and please tell me who they're being addressed to.
Addressing the question to them very quickly, the question is if someone's downtown and they have to give a ride and they can only give one person a ride and it's a fellow observant Jew or someone not, I would follow the way of Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook. I would give the chesed, how he extended it out to someone not observant who he came in contact with, was more than, even though he loved his Talmidim like his own children, he never had children. So I'm saying that your caring and sharing should be in a world where people are tinuk shenishba, that they're grabbed up by secular society. You should extend more caring to the non-observant.
Is this a question?
That's a question. Should you not extend more caring to the non-observant in order to show them that you are a living Kiddush Hashem? And the other question over here is, I wanted to know what's the ramifications of having the secular people, the results of the secular. Were we able to open up more where the secular professors now were not anti-religious, they were pro. When they would teach in the university, Hebrew University, when they would teach, they would have more understanding for Torah and respect for Torah as a result of bringing them in on Yom Kippur. That's my question.
We're going to take all the questions.
All the questions, sure.
This question is for everybody on the panel. A lot of the discussion that I've heard tonight it focuses on Jewish people or Jewish communities in abstract. And it seemed, from my perspective, particularly grown-ups or people who are already in institutions, already in their own communities. But there's an interesting feature of the Jewish community, which is that for 4 years, let's say outside of the Haredi community, there's this thing called university. And it's a place where Jews of all different stripes have at least the possibility to interact. And I wanted to know if you thought that this was a change the situation in some way, that the university is available, or is it, you know, really irrelevant to the entire picture of Jewish unity?
Wait.
So I just bring up the concept, an issue of marriage. So to Dr. Lau, if you talk about the idea that if you have strong enough confidence in your belief that you're comfortable doing things with other people. So if you're, let's say, religious, if one of your children want to marry somebody non-religious, what do you say to them?
I have a question for two different people. So, one question for Rabbi Brady. So, what is happening with the conversion process in Israel and beyond?
Okay.
This question is for Rabbi Lowe. It seems that the consensus that I got is that in North America there's one model which allows for more diversity without any threats. Basically, everybody can do what they like. Whereas in Israel, because of the close link between the Israeli law and the halachic law, especially in marriage, that it creates a necessity for uniformity. Do you think, Rabbi Lowe, that given what is happening, that in the long term you would be happy with an American model or Western model within Israel and a separation of the Israeli secular law and the religious law, and basically adopt the model that has been in place for many centuries in Galut and have that same model in Israel in order to allow to have unity without uniformity?
Okay, so one more, quickly.
For Rabbi Adlerstein, I was a little puzzled by your quoting Rabbi Wolf Kalman and Leshevach, because if in fact you feel you've learned something from him, and which would be, I know what I am, I'm proud of it, I'm not threatened. Why do you have such difficulty having, and I'm not talking about Yom Kippur Dafka, having a conservative, a rabbi, or any other kind of Jew speaking, if you're that comfortable?
Okay, let's take it in order. The first question would be for you. Should you give Dafka, the non-observant Jew, a ride?
So result-oriented chesed isn't a form of chesed at all. It's merely a self-serving way to expand the community. It's in the right time and the right moment. All of us are content to be self-serving doers of chesed. But I think that in reality, one's supposed to provide more chesed to people who are more within one's social circle than the stranger. I think that the impact of university is fascinating, but not profoundly novel. The secular and the religious have been mixing since time immemorial, if not in university, then in the fields. And I don't think that the notion that adolescents use their opportunity to grow up to ponder the close other is such a novel idea. So the framework of the university might be a new idea, but the notion that people in adolescence do this has been around for centuries. The question about conversion is a fascinating one, and I'm speaking about conversion tomorrow, and that's enough.
Rabbi Lau, so you were asked whether after the secular professors came, whether they were more open to Yadut as a result of that.
I will answer two questions together, I think, and I will do it very short. As you know, or you should know, in Israel, if you are not religious, you have no place in the synagogue. It's not like in Western world that the community take care about the whole Jews. Never mind if it's Reform, Orthodox, Conservative, or Construction. But every Jew finds himself in a community. In Israel, if you are religious, you have synagogue. If you are not religious, you are lost. And many, many Israelis don't know the way to any synagogue. And the act that I invited a professor, secular professor, the last 3 years, 4 years, to my synagogue, it's not a gimmick, but it's try to show the way that they accept in my shul. And I can tell you that hundreds of secular students and adults come over Yom Kippur because that they see that they have kavod and makom in my shul. If it affects them back to university, as you know, as we all know, the relationship between people, if you have the faith of the other, so the other will show your faith in his place. And Baruch Hashem, it will happen slowly, and I believe that we can change it le'at le'at. Kim'ah kim'ah, we say the redemption will come, it will not come fast.
And you were asked how you would respond if one of your children married a secular Jew.
You know, this is in the end of the whole discussion, in the end, after everything, we return back to our Polish mother and we said, listen, the intimate feeling that we have, and I want to mention to the whole panel members, you know, tonight is the memorial day of my kehila in Piotrkow, Yud Alef Cheshvan. It's memorial day of my grandfather who killed in Treblinka. He was a Haredi rabbi. And his picture is on my head all the time. And for me to speak against the Haredi world, it's against my grandfather. And I'm very careful with that. So in the end of the day, when Rabbi Breuler talk about the circles, so we know it's true. We have families and we very care about the immediate family that we are working with. And question of marriage in and out is coming from that line. And I think that it will not be wrong to mention also that tonight is the memorial day after Yitzhak Rabin. So we are fine the intimate feelings and the nationalism feelings going together, and we need to find the line between these two.
I'm going to throw over one question to Dr. Finkelman. Should the American model of separation of church and state be adopted in Israel?
So by way of at least partial answer to that question, the relationship of religion and state in Israel is profoundly diseased. I think that there are enormous opportunities that the State of Israel created for religion, Torah, sensitivity in the public sphere, opportunities for religion opened up tremendous opportunities. And I think to a great degree, the system is mired in power politics, petty nonsense, factionalism, and if in fact the situation is diseased, then it needs to be replaced, and the question is with what? And the model, at least in the United States of America, of real separation of church and state, that's not going to happen in Israel. It's not realistic. At the very least, the possibility that the Israeli government would stop funding religious institutions is unimaginable. But something a lot more pluralistic. The Torah, the rabbis, the establishment was given an enormous amount of power and have done some good with it and a fair amount of bad. And if they lose that power, if they lose those opportunities, I imagine they will have themselves to blame. But I think the model that might replace it is not precisely going to look like what happens in North America. And I don't know what it would look like. But given the current conditions, my suspicion is that it's time to start thinking about alternatives.
The last question is for Rabbi Adlerstein. I'm going to fill the question out a little bit. The question essentially is, if Orthodoxy is confident of its ground, then why are we unwilling to allow for interdenominational dialogue, for non-Orthodox rabbis to speak on a forum? Why does it seem, and frankly, we could even start with intra-Orthodox, despite your optimistic rendering, my experience has been quite the opposite. And it seems like the Orthodox conversation is slowly disappearing as people of different ideological camps don't wish to speak on the same forum, you being a noteworthy and gracious exception. If we have this confidence of its claim, our claim to truth and authenticity, then why does it often seem like we are so hesitant and fearful to speak to one another in forums like this one, whether it's within Orthodoxy or interdenominationally?
To address the second question first, I don't think the question is valid because I don't believe that those who object to intra-Orthodox dialogue are all that confident in what they believe. They may be confident in what they believe, but they're less confident about whether their own communities will be able to stand up to the onslaught of ideas that may lead them in other directions. So I don't think there's any contradiction, like it or not, and I don't like it. I think that's the truth. As far as lending a platform to people in other denominations, this is something that has to be rethunk probably every few decades. I'm still presenting the old thinking. At one point in my life, I thought I would strike off in a new direction, only to find out that the realities of the old system really were more true than I was willing to admit. Let me take your question even further. We pay a terrible price for not having that dialogue, for not opening up, because it closes us off from audiences where we could be spreading a lot of Torah and a lot of mitzvos. Nonetheless, there are two objections. I will leave it to you to decide whether they apply or not. The two objections are one that I mentioned before, that there are people who desperately want our nod to say that the Orthodox have changed their attitude. They're now more willing to dialogue with us. They're more accepting of us. They're finally coming around to realizing that we are all on one continuum. We are all one people. We're better than a continuum. But when it comes to certain principles, we're not on the same page at all. And we cannot afford to give people the embrace of acceptance to lend credence to things that are ziyuf HaTorah, that are perversions of what the Torah is. The second objection is a halachic one, and that is if you know that somebody is going to address your congregation and speak kfira, we'll leave it to you to define it each in his own way. Dr. Finkelman and I obviously will disagree on the definition, but every part of the community will have its definition of what kfira is. And there are people outside of Orthodoxy who will get up and spout kfira. Some people can do very well with it and should be exposed to it, others should not. That's a halachic determination and has to be made. And often the simplest way is not to deal with it and just say, he's a kofar, we're not going to let him in. I will close with reminding you of two other yard sites, one of them not so well known. It's my own father, Oliver Shalom's yard site, whose own reaction to this would be, couldn't you have gone to medical school instead? And at the same time, it is the yard site of Rachel Imenu, who will remain for all times the icon of devotion to her entire people, all inclusive people, and the hope that v'shavu banim l'gvulam.
I would end it there, but I'm actually curious because I find what you just said astounding. How is it that people on the same panel, that if you sit with people and you radically disagree with them, so you're sitting here, and a conservative rabbi is sitting here, and a reform rabbi is sitting here, and everybody in the audience is intelligent, right? We have an intelligent audience. How is it that sitting with them and them seeing radical disagreement gets converted into legitimizing the other person?
Can I answer that question?
How does that happen?
I think it's very important. When American political parties meet, they don't let the parties into the conversation who are out of the pale. And that we all understand that there are Republicans and Democrats. There are also libertarians, and there's a Green Leaf Party, and a whole host of, and Vegetarians in Action. There are a whole host of parties out there. And political organizations, no different than halakhic organizations, bear a responsibility to only give a seat to the on the table to views that they deem reasonable. Without disagreeing...
You know what this is? This is your cat analogy again, dressed up.
Without disagreeing, without addressing the question of where exactly we should draw the line, because I actually think that we do need to rethink where we draw the line, because we've drawn too conservative a line, When a local federation said in the South that we're going to allow a Messianic church, a Messianic synagogue, to affiliate with the federation, I took the position that the Orthodox synagogue should disaffiliate. I don't think that we should disaffiliate from Orthodox Conservative Reform, but when the Federation said, well, there's a Messianic synagogue in town, they should be part of the Federation Synagogue Council. So I said, no, no, no. If they're going to be around the table, we're not around the table. And I took this position very forcefully to the Orthodox rabbi in that community. I don't know where the line is. And I can say this person drew the wrong line. And I don't have a problem thinking that the Orthodox community drew the wrong line. But to the extent that you're arguing that there should never be a line...
I didn't argue that. That's inaccurate. I did not argue that.
But I want to ask you a question.
The cat is the Messianic Jew.
But
You're just throwing out false analogies.
But I don't know...
There is a huge difference between a conservative rabbi sitting next to you and somebody who proclaims Jesus as their Savior. And you know that, and I know that.
I 100% right. agree with that. I'm not, and I don't have a problem not liking the line that Orthodoxy has drawn. But the notion that the reason why I won't sit with a Messianic Jew is because I don't wish to validate him as an authentic member of the Jewish community. That's why I won't sit with him. It's because my sitting with him validates his membership as a member of our community. That validation is of some value and importance. The conservative and reform community might be so well established that we need to, as Rabbi Adlerstein said, rethink our position. But the notion that you expressed, which is how could any smart person ever think...
In that context, yes.
Okay.
Yes, obviously.
Let me chip away.
So we'll be here when both of you rethink your positions. We'll be here.
Okay.
If I may chip away at your clarity a little bit by giving you a Maase Shehayah. And like Rabbi Broid, I don't know where we should draw the line, but it'll be something disturbing to think of. I generally don't sit on such panels, only because I've gotten Piskei Halacha from my Rebbeim. My heart really does lie on the other side, within reason. A colleague of mine, who does participate, recently found himself invited to a forum before Rosh Hashanah to share approaches to the season and to Scripture. Right? Now, can you really sit on the same panel with somebody who believes that such Scripture is not divine at all? And you'll share your comments. Well, when he did, and one rabbi, not Orthodox, talking about, I don't remember if it was Parshat Akedah or something else, began her presentation by saying, I'm not sure what the dude who wrote this was on when he wrote it. How comfortable are you continuing the conversation?
Since you're affiliated with the Wiesenthal Center, I'll tell you something that Simon Wiesenthal once said, that Joseph Telushkin quotes. He was talking about somebody who was the Jews who were defending the right of Nazis to march in Skokie. So he said, you can be a Jew and be stupid, but it's not a mitzvah. Okay, that's my answer to you. Thank you very much.